Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, we have to talk about presidential politics, so we are lucky to have Jonathan Allen, number one New York Times bestselling author of a very depressing book called Shattered, and an NBC. What is your title at NBC? You're a political guru, political analyst, reporter.
I'm a national politics reporter, and sometimes write analysis pieces.
Okay, well, let's talk about this. And but by the way, I actually went back and was looking at your book Shattered, which I think was probably like the first post 2016 book to come out, wasn't it? I mean, you guys were right out of the blocks with that book.
It was certainly the first deeply reported look at the election, and we came out in April of 2017, really an autopsy of the Clinton campaign and what went wrong, a behind-the-scenes look.
So much.
Feel it kind of from twist to turn.
Yeah, what was good about it, of course, was an autopsy while the body was still warm and still twitching, but you really got a sense that there was so much that was dysfunctional in all of that. And I guess the question is, have Democrats learned the right lessons from the Clinton debacle, the shambolic failure to win that election?
We shall see. It's interesting to watch this race develop and to see what people are taking from, you know, what these various candidates and campaigns are taking from the Clinton campaign, what they're throwing out. And in some cases, they are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And I personally think that's a mistake, in part because she did win the Democratic primary and she did do a fair number of things right in the campaign. And so I think we will see over the course of certainly the primary, somebody will have picked the right things out to sort of co-opt from that campaign, and some others may not have picked the right things. And then in the general election, you'll see, you know, what do you keep and what do you get rid of from a campaign that lost by 70,000 votes, roughly over three states. You know, as an example, you see Elizabeth Warren having laid out a policy agenda very early. That's something Hillary Clinton did. She got a lot of stakeholders in the room early, put out a platform. And I think it's one of the reasons you didn't see her flip-flop on a lot of issues, certainly during the primary. And even when she moved a little bit to the left in the general election, it wasn't big flip-flops on issues. The one that you can think of is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but it really allowed her to kind of claim a big space on the center left. And it made it hard for Bernie Sanders, I think, to find a ton of issues where he could hit her on consistently without running the risk of going too far left.
Which of course raises the question of whether or not our politics is really about issues anymore. Whether at the end of the day, given the polarization that we have, would that these white papers actually make a difference other than finding a way to define your candidacy or strike the pose that has certain symbolic value? What percentage of voters actually cares about those specific policy recommendations? I was talking to somebody who's an Elizabeth Warren fan, and I mentioned, hey, you know, the entire plan is predicated upon this massive wealth tax, which I think is extremely unlikely ever to happen legislatively, legally, constitutionally, all of those things. Is that a problem? And you know, it's almost like a flip side of some of the Trump supporters, like, yeah, no, we don't really expect that we're going to do that. But I just like the fact that she's fighting on those particular grounds.
Absolutely. I think for the most part, for most voters, it's a matter of signaling where you stand and what you believe in. And it ties into your sort of persona as a candidate. What is it that you're willing to fight for? Rather than necessarily the particular policy prescription. And, you know, I mean, the other thing I would say about that just is that if Elizabeth Warren had branded it a wealth tariff, maybe President Trump would just accept it and put it through the Congress.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen, oh, good grief. somebody got to tell President Trump that the word tariff, isn't it Arabic? Doesn't it come from whatever? Okay, so let's talk about obviously some interesting developments in the presidential race. You have a very interesting piece about Mayor Pete, and here's an interesting moment where you have Joe Biden finally going to Iowa, giving a very, very high profile speech. He and Donald Trump are really in the trenches firing at one another, these two old guys basically implying that guy's too old, he's lost it. And then you got Mayor Pete, standing up and giving more than 7,000 word speech on foreign policy. So talk about this interesting dynamic, because we focused a lot on the divide in Democrats on race, on gender and ideology, but there's also a really dramatic, and it was really highlighted over the last 48 hours here, really dramatic division or contrast on age in generational perspective. So tell me what Mayor Pete's doing.
Right. I mean, I think what we saw yesterday was a little bit of a remake of the movie Grumpy Old Men, with Joe Biden and Donald Trump playing the parts of Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. And I guess I'm dating myself a little bit because that movie's pretty old.
No, I'm a grumpy old man, and I enjoyed that.
But, you know, you have those two sort of going at it in the trenches and you know, basically hammering each other, kind of insulting each other. And then here's Pete Buttigieg, who's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, obviously with less of the sort of Washington credentials of foreign policy experience. He hasn't been president of the United States, vice president of the United States, or chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee like the other two have been. And he gets up and gives this foreign policy speech, which I suspect is the most significant foreign policy speech given by a former mayor or mayor of an Indiana city since Dick Lugar. And he basically says, look, we're not going to solve our problems on the international stage. We're not going to create national security or good foreign policy or have stronger domestic policy connected to our foreign policy if we are looking back toward the 1950s, meaning Donald Trump, or having a return to the 1990s, meaning Joe Biden's view of the world. And so what he was trying to say is you got to turn the corner and you got to have some new ideas for what American foreign policy looks like in the future. And I think that if Buttigieg is to emerge as the Democratic nominee or to become president of the United States, people will look back at that speech as a moment where he distinguished himself in the class of Democratic candidates as somebody who could go toe-to-toe with these other two candidates on an issue that a lot of the other Democrats aren't able to or certainly haven't yet. And he used his standing as a veteran of the Afghanistan war as a platform to make those arguments and say, hey, I've been over there. I've witnessed this firsthand, and used that as to make his call for a repeal. And if you talk to the folks on his campaign, he means a repeal and replacement of the 2001 authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan that has been used by successive administrations to continue what he refers to as endless wars, meaning that you can basically go after anyone you want under that 2001 AUMF. It's not very limited to Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. or to Afghanistan.
So can we define what the Buttigieg doctrine would look like?
He said he wanted to resist the idea of a Buttigieg doctrine, but you start to get some sense of it. You start to get a sense that what he's talking about is a very limited use of military force, as he put it, as a last option. Not that you would ever take it off the table, but that you would be very reluctant to use it. He framed World War II and the response to 9/11, the immediate response to 9/11, not the ongoing response to 9/11, as examples of when the United States was in the right to use military force, and then used Vietnam and the Iraq War, sort of the secondary response to 9/11, as examples of where our foreign policy and national security policy went astray and being too eager to use military force. So I think that was a key component of it. I think building alliances and maintaining alliances was a key part of that. I think, you know, if you listen to what he said, you get the impression that he's not a big fan of the president cozying up mm-hmm. to countries and dictators that are not in line with the United States and its values, and not a fan of rejecting longtime allies.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me about Mayor Pete is there's no question about it that he is progressive, and yet he has these grace notes in his speech, whereas some of the other progressives seem to feel the need to define themselves by insulting, you know, Republicans or conservatives, even non-Trumpian conservatives. Mayor Pete has a way of expressing himself. For example, I mean, he quotes Dwight Eisenhower, you know, and he's very unequivocal and very comfortable talking about American exceptionalism, which I'm not sure that all of the Democrats are able to do that easily, you know. And he, as you mentioned, you know, he you know, paid tribute to Dick Lugar, and he didn't actually name Reagan by name, but he did really sort of invoke that imagery of America as the shining city on a hill. Here's the quote that jumped out at me. You know, at home and abroad, it is not too late for America to restore her leadership position as a beacon of values that are both universal and at the core of the American project. It's hard to stand for human rights abroad when we're turning away asylum seekers at our own border. The idea that the American way is superior will be difficult to authenticate as long as our federal government is liable to shut down over policy disagreements. Strength is more than military power. It's our power of inspiration. You know, frankly, Jonathan, I can imagine almost any Republican who was on that stage in 2016, with the possible exception of Rand Paul and Donald Trump, saying those words.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the values he's espousing and the ones that he's articulating are very similar to those that have formed the basic foreign policy thought that. I think he articulated this in an interesting way, that there is a value to internationalism that the current president doesn't recognize, and that is somewhat different from, at the same time, the internationalism embraced by the establishment over the course of the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, in that he said he believes that it really has to be connected to American interests. And I think what he's trying to do is find a middle ground that recognizes the appetite among Americans to ensure that when we are looking at other countries and we're looking at alliances, that we're examining how our trade relationships and how our security relationships, how they affect the American voter, how they affect the American consumer, and how strength within our own country can be part of that. Being that part of being a beacon for others, and how our own values and being an example can be a beacon. And so you look at the history of the last 50, 60, 70 years, there are a mix of those tools that have been used, right? Sometimes it is military force in an alliance. Sometimes it is diplomacy. Sometimes it is development dollars going across the world. And what we've seen certainly in the current administration is probably less of a use of the set of tools in that toolbox. And I think, you know, even under some of the Democratic administrations, perhaps a different set of tools being used, and maybe not the entire panoply and the proper balance from the view of Buttigieg in terms of trying to ensure that those domestic values are connected to the international values. He talked about being in Afghanistan and navigating, you know, these dangerous streets in Afghanistan and trying to figure out how does that connect to paving the streets in South Bend. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. There are very few people that can speak competently from the one level to the other level, because there are a lot of pieces in between.
You know, that's what the fascinating thing about presidential politics is that sometimes, you know, the spotlight of being a presidential candidate diminishes the candidate. You know, the number of people who have rolled in with high expectations who then withered under all of this. And I think we can come up with lots of names of people who faded very quickly and are right now fading quickly. But Mayor Pete is one of those, I think, unusual candidates who seems to be gaining in stature. Now, by the way, the flip side of this, and we just mentioned this briefly before we started the podcast, on the flip side, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand, is that how you pronounce it, Gillibrand?
That's right.
Okay, I'm sorry. Is one of those candidates who I don't think is growing in stature in the campaign. I think she's been pretty consistently at zero in the polls, and she was in Des Moines talking to the Des Moines Register, and they were asking her about whether there was any contradiction between her support for judicial independence and her insistence that there would be a litmus test when it came to the abortion issue. And she gave an answer, and let me just read it here. She said, "I think there are some issues that have such moral clarity that we have as a society decided the other side is not acceptable. Imagine saying that it's okay to appoint a judge who's racist or anti-Semitic or homophobic. Asking someone to appoint someone who takes away basic human rights of any group of people in America, I don't think those are political issues anymore." Which, I don't know, I read as equating being pro-life with being racist and saying that we're not even debating this, that the people on the other side of this issue, because the abortion issue had such quote-unquote moral clarity, they just are not acceptable participants in our process. And I don't know, Jonathan. That maybe that's going to play well with the base, but I'm not sure she's got quite the tone right.
Yeah, I think the base is important to her because she's trying to win a nomination right now. And given where she is with polling, I don't think she has to worry a whole lot about a general election audience anytime soon. One of the things she does have to be concerned about is that she has so damaged her own reputation and credibility within the Democratic Party. She may have to worry about a primary challenge in her next Senate election. So she may be trying to ensure that she's got as many allies as possible going forward within the Democratic Party. I mean, you got to think of any number of New York politicians who are looking at her presidential run and thinking to themselves, she could be taken out in a Senate race. If the, I think for many people in this country, whichever side of the abortion issue they're on, they believe it's an issue of moral clarity. But because it's an issue that has two sides and two very strong sides that believe that there's moral clarity, I think if you take a step back, one would say that there is a lot of tension on the morality of abortion within our society broadly. And to not recognize that that people who disagree on abortion can come at it from two different directions and have two very strong beliefs that are formed by their morality, by their culture, by their religion, by their ethics, is to not fully evaluate or to not really accept the true feelings of a lot of Americans.
Yeah, I had two reactions to this. Number one, I think you're exactly right. She just can't let anybody get to the left of her. I mean, this is part of this, no enemies to the left trend that you're seeing, and particularly with her, but you're seeing this in the Democratic Party. The second is that sometimes, when you're taking a position that you haven't taken before, it's like speaking a foreign language. And it kind of reminded me of, when Mitt Romney decided that he was not just conservative, he was severely conservative. Or when Donald Trump was asked by Chris Matthews, when 5 minutes after he decided he was pro-life as opposed to pro-abortion, and Matthews asked him, well, should women who have abortions go to jail? And that Donald Trump hadn't thought about that for more than 30 seconds in his entire life, and he sort of blundered into, well, yes, there should be consequences. I kind of get the sense that Gillibrand hasn't quite figured out how to articulate her position, except to be as woke as possible. Okay, so let's just talk about all the polls, and I want you to help me break all of this down, because it's when I put out my newsletter this morning, I had the question mark, the Joe Biden landslide. We have this new Quinnipiac poll out showing Joe Biden with a 13-point lead nationally over Donald Trump. Of course, this is a national poll. It's not the key states. It's very, very early. President Dukakis can tell you about those early polls. But give me a sense, and then there are other polls showing that he continues to have a relatively healthy, durable, not overwhelming lead in among Democrats. So how are you reading these polls? How do the pros look at these polls?
It's a great question. I think the key word that you said there was early. And I know we all want to be able to read as much as we can and as fast as we can. I think the president has a huge challenge in front of him, which is that he remains somebody who has created an exceptionally strong base, but has not found a way to move outside that base and has spent a good deal of his time alienating people outside of it, not just the people who were opposed to him in 2016, but a lot of swing voters or even voted for him and took a chance on him, but were not entirely sold on him, people who voted against Hillary Clinton. And so he either has to expand from that base laterally, meaning pick up some of those swing voters, or he has to turn out an incredible number of people who agree with him who didn't show up last time. And if he's able to do that, then it is, you know, then these polls won't necessarily pick that up. They're modeled on you know, past turnout performance, and you know, so they are basically pollsters attempting to figure out what the electorate's going to look like. And if there's some huge surge of people that that show up that didn't show up previously, that won't be reflected in the polls. But when you're talking about like a 13-point lead for Biden, it's hard to imagine that if the election were held today and Joe Biden had a 13-point lead, that he wouldn't win on an election held today. That said, there are basically two dozen Democratic candidates. The president isn't running against one person. He tends to run, you know, scorched earth races. I expect that you will see by the general election what I would think of as sort of a Harry Reid type race, the former senator from Nevada, who was deeply unpopular in his own state, but was able to make his opponent Sharon Angle, I think it was in 2010, so unpopular that he ended up winning. So early, and even on the, you know, when you look at the Democratic primary side, Biden has a lead. When you look inside the numbers, a lot of the voters still haven't heard of many of the Democratic candidates.
Well, that's true. And by the way, the other Democratic candidates also lead him. But let's go through what the Trump people actually have a relatively plausible argument, saying, okay, these numbers don't mean anything because this is going to be a binary choice. And if 2016 told us anything, it's that the vote is not up or down on Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump went into Election Day as, you know, the most unpopular candidate ever to run on a major party ticket, with the exception, of course, of Hillary Clinton. And of course, as you're exactly right, they figure that no matter who the Democrats put up, they will hammer that person as out of touch, you know, as a socialist, as somebody who's going to raise your taxes, do all of those things. And so, you know, having lived through one lesser of two evils campaign, is there any reason to think that 2020 won't be the same thing?
I think they're going to try to do the exact same thing. I think there are candidates that it's easier to do that with than others. You know, I mean, I think the fear for, at one level, the fear for the Trump campaign is going to be that they won't know who their opponent is for a longer period of time rather than a shorter period of time, and that they end up with somebody that they have to try to sell as being as bad as Hillary Clinton, in the way that they sold Hillary Clinton as being bad, without the 25 years of sort of built up antipathy toward her among Republicans and among non-affiliated voters, that in order to run that kind of campaign, they're going to have to do it over a much shorter period of time and maybe against a lesser known candidate.
Well, what do you make of these reports back and forth about what the internal polls say? Because there have been a number of reports suggesting that Trump's own polls show that he's in really deep trouble in some of these key swing states. And of course, he's denouncing that as fake news. What are you hearing?
Three things. A, it's true that he's in trouble in a lot of the swing states. We see that from public polling, in addition to the reports, which are totally credible, from about the internal polling. B, I think that his team wanted to show him internal polling that created the impression in him that he needed to have needed to get energetic and excited about this campaign. One thing that you hear when you talk to folks who are close to the president is that he really doesn't get excited about campaigns unless he has an enemy, unless he has a foil, and that's the case right now. There's not one person that he's really focused on, and we see this with his Twitter feuds. I mean, he likes to have a foil. He likes to have somebody that he can be against. He wants to portray somebody else as bad or evil or malicious, and so they're trying to figure out a way to get him charged up, and I think showing him polling numbers that are bad was an attempt to do that. And then, you know, his reaction to it, the third part, I would say, is, you know, the president will say anything. So I'm not I'm not sure that we should believe him that the public polls and the private polls don't show him in bad shape. He often says conflicting things in the same sentence. So I think we should take the other evidence that is much stronger than than what he provides as sort of a comment that it's not true and believe the evidence that is factual.
Okay. And looming over all of this, of course, is history and the modeling, which would say that with an economy this strong, this good, the incumbent always wins. Why would that not be the case in 2020?
So you're right about that, generally speaking. I mean, you look at a good economy, the president has a ton of advantages in general, an incumbent president, and you would think this guy's in great position to win re-election. A couple of things, and that may end up being the case, a couple of things I would look at. Number one is the inelasticity of voters' views toward him. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot that makes him more or less popular in terms of events. The economy has been what it has been, essentially on a fairly steady trajectory throughout his presidency, and it has not moved the numbers much. We have seen him go through negotiations on trade and on nuclear nonproliferation and high points and low points. We've seen the border crisis, and none of it seems to move his numbers, which makes me wonder whether continued economic growth would move his numbers a lot. Presumably, a collapsing economy could hurt him some, but I think there's a relative inelasticity to his numbers. The other thing is it depends a little bit on how the other side runs against him. I think we saw him run against the economy in 2016, even though the economy was, if not going gangbusters, certainly growing and having grown steadily over the course of the previous several years coming out of the post-financial crash recession. Just like Bill Clinton ran against what at the time was an improving economy. We all remember it's the economy, stupid, and George H.W. Bush had a recession, but the economy during that election was actually climbing up and was actually getting stronger. So candidate runs against a good economy and says it's bad, and the public often believes him, especially if the average person doesn't feel like they're getting the benefit of an improving economy.
Yeah, and on the binary choice, I know the Republicans are thinking that if they can run against the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, they're going to be in really good shape. They think those are disastrous. It's kind of hard for me to imagine how a candidate who was supporting the Green New Deal, how they would fare in the industrial areas like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin, but we're a long way from that. So one of the stories of today is that Nancy Pelosi is apparently telling people that she's like done with Trump. That they're so, Jonathan, does this mean that like there'll be no more infrastructure weeks? I mean, what do we do?
Infrastructure week is like the cockroach of Capitol Hill. It would survive a nuclear holocaust, I think. I mean, there will definitely be infrastructure weeks. Whether or not they get anything done is another question. I think what she meant was she's kind of sick of responding to Trump. But it's hard to know. I mean, the president went out and said recently that he wasn't going to legislate if he was being investigated, and then sort of spun off that talking point to other things. I think somebody must have pointed out to him that it didn't sound good that he was prioritizing his own political fate over the public policy agenda. Presumably somebody will point out to Nancy Pelosi that saying she doesn't want to deal with the president of the United States doesn't sound terribly good to voters who would like to see Congress and the White House work together no matter who the personalities are. I think they are fed up with each other. I think they, I think they both knew that there was some value in pretending that they were going to work together on some issues and thought that they might be able to find some common ground, but neither side was really, really willing to do what it took politically to make that happen. The president is in a bad spot because he can't get the right wing of his party on board for spending money on infrastructure. I mean, it's so ultimately, in order to get a deal done with Nancy Pelosi, he's going to have to break to break the Freedom Caucus. And that doesn't mean he couldn't get the votes for it. It just means that he'd be getting his, you know, the folks that are involved with his base and engaged with his base to be, you know, to be trashing his bill as he moves it forward.
So speaking of the Freedom Caucus, interesting, Justin Amash leaving and or being thrown out, one of the founding members, still remaining an outlier. And Politico is reporting that, of course, the Trump White House wants to squash him like a bug, want to make him the next Mark Sanford. So where does Justin Amash go?
Well, I mean, for the short term, he spends a lot of time talking to Jerry Nadler in the House chamber, as he did
really?
Yesterday. I mean, there is a commonality now of Amash and Chairman Nadler and many of the other, I guess, about 60 Democrats who have now publicly called for an impeachment inquiry to begin. You know, he'll be a voice that will get a lot of attention because he makes that call for the impeachment process bipartisan. You know, for the moment, he is something of a Jeff Flake type character, although impeachment, I think, is bigger than anything that Flake ever said. And the fact that he's, you know, out there on the record on something like that is different.
Okay, Jeff Flake type character, what do you mean? Jeff Flake as the lonely voice of conscience, or Jeff Flake as the utterly ineffectual?
If they end up getting to a point where the president is impeached, then it's no longer ineffectual.
But he's not
persuading any Republicans.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen there? Where are they going to go? Nancy Pelosi seems to be pretty dug in on all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I've always taken the view that that her first priority is to try to keep her caucus unified. I look at it from a very parochial standpoint of her job being to try to keep the House in Democratic hands, and the key to that being to keep them together, because if they fracture, it's very easy for the president to defeat them both rhetorically now and politically later. And she has a lot of members who don't want to have a vote on impeachment, particularly those who won in swing districts last time where they had to appeal to Trump voters. So whether or not they think the president should be impeached, a lot of those folks just simply don't want to have a vote, because it means they either have to reject the base of the party within their district, or they have to reject the Trump voters who voted for them. And that's just an uncomfortable position.
Yeah. So going back to the whether she's done with them or whether they can still get a deal done, there's this debt limit coming again. It feels like we're always sort of Lucy in the football. This is going to be a big thing, and it doesn't really happen. But apparently there's no deal in place. Nobody's talking about doing anything, and this is necessary to avoid about $100 billion in spending cuts that would take effect at the beginning of the year. So I don't know. Are we headed for another one of these fiscal crises, government shutdown, kabuki theaters?
Yes.
Yes, really. Yes.
I don't even know if it's kabuki though. I mean, there's no.
Really? You didn't hedge that. You just said yes.
I mean, we're certainly headed for the crisis. You know, the moment where where everybody throws their hands in the air and says this could damage our the nation's fiscal standing. And there doesn't seem to be any urgency about it. There doesn't seem to be any movement on it. You've got White House officials who in the past, and I'm thinking about Nick Mulvaney, the OMB director, who have in the past been perfectly willing to say there's no reason to raise the debt limit, who are now the first people to want the debt limit raised. You've got, I think Democrats in Congress who aren't going to hold it hostage per se, but also don't have any reason to speed to the administration's rescue on it. And we'll probably look for some way in which to roll it into something else. And yeah, I mean, you could have a disaster on your hands. On the other hand, they could quickly resolve it and decide to fight on other issues. I mean, there's any number of things they could fight on. The White House just put out a veto message on some of the appropriations bills yesterday. They want to fight over contraception and abortion, and they want to fight over border wall funding and the ability of the administration to transfer funds to the border wall from Homeland Security money. So there's a lot for them to fight over. Maybe they will choose to do what most people on Capitol Hill think is the responsible thing and raise the debt limit. I think a lot of Americans don't understand that what they're doing there is simply ensuring that the U.S. doesn't default on the debt that it's already incurred.
Yeah, which is generally a good idea, not to default on something. But again, we've become so accustomed to demagoguing these issues and to using all of this. In any case, so Jonathan, what are you looking at for the rest of the week? What are you obsessed about?
Well, we've got Donald Trump Jr. Is having a closed-door meeting today with the House Intelligence Committee, so that should be interesting to see what comes out of that, if anything. Making some sort of adjustment to his previous testimony. Maybe not. He apparently said he doesn't think anything has to be corrected. I think the Senate Intelligence Committee said he said some things that he might want to correct. We've got a bunch of presidential candidates running around this week. So, and of course, the president could say anything at any time that disrupts everyone's lives.
Exactly. Because it's whatever. We all just live in his world. Jonathan Allen, thank you so much. Jonathan Allen, number one New York Times bestselling author of really the first of the scary autopsies of what happened with the Clinton campaign. It is Shattered, an NBC political reporter. Again, Jonathan, thanks for the time today.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.